Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Pulse. This week, we're going to be going back to our monthly book club on the same page. This week, we're going to be talking about the book The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, which is a 2007 nonfiction book by legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin. This is based in part on exclusive interviews that he had with the justices and former law clerks. And he basically profiles the justices of the United States Supreme Court, the functioning of that institution, and how it's changed over the years. This book was one of many books that came out at the time that was just in time for the 2008 presidential election, where the message was that the future of the court would be at stake. Toobin reveals an institution at a moment of transition when decades of conservative disgust with the court have finally produced a conservative majority with major changes in store on such issues such as abortion, civil rights, presidential power, and church-state relations. The Nine tells the story of the court through personalities, from Anthony Kennedy's overwhelming sense of self-importance to Clarence Thomas's well-intended grievances against his critics, to Dave Souter's odd 19th century lifestyle. There's also, for the first time, the full behind-the-scenes story of Bush v. Gore and Sandra Day O'Connor's fateful breach with George W. Bush, the president she helped place into office. A little bit of a spoiler, or to kind of wrap your head around it before we go in, since that's all kind of a little vague. Basically, the plot of this book is that the decades-long fight by a new and more extreme brand of conservative to take control of the Supreme Court, it is a fight that fails during the 80s and the 90s, and even in the early 21st century, despite the fact that Republican appointees far outnumbered Democratic appointees on the court. The second page seems to tell the future by saying, through the tense standoff of the Berger and Rehnquist years, a powerful conservative rebellion against the court was building. It has been, in many respects, a remarkable ideological offensive, nurtured at various times in such locales as elite law schools, evangelical churches, and most importantly and most recently, the White House. Its agenda has remained largely the same over the decades: reverse Roe v. Wade and allow states to ban abortion, expand executive power, and racial preferences intended to assist African Americans, speed executions, welcome religion into the public sphere. That's the quote that Toobin gives us to kind of get our heads around it before he launches into the
book. Yeah, so the book starts with the funeral of Chief Justice William Rehnquist and the retirement of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor in 2005. There was a long-running transformation of the Supreme Court from liberal to conservative over roughly 35 years, and that transformation was complete, according to the author, upon the death of Rehnquist. These individuals were replaced by appointees that were far more conservative: Roberts as Chief Justice and Alito as Associate Justice. These men were in the new conservative mold, or as Toobin put it, in the mold of the new Republican Party of George W. Bush. After that, the book follows a chronological order, starting with the presidency of Ronald Reagan. Part one covers the administrations of Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton. Reagan ushered in a new era of conservatism when he became president in 1980, but the Supreme Court was still firmly liberal overall at that point, as it was nearing the end of the Warren Burger Court. Law schools were seen as bastions of liberal thought, and there began to be some pushback against this. Some law students founded what would become the Federalist Society, which is an organization devoted to fostering conservative principles in the legal system.
What's insane to me is the Federalist Society. They're so insane to me. I wonder how many people get them by name recognition. Their full name is the Federalists for Law and Public Policy Studies. And like Mike said, they're an American legal organization of conservatives and libertarians that advocate for supposedly textualist and originalist interpretation of the United States Constitution, which, never mind. And the society currently has chapters at more than 200 law schools. They are seriously one of the most influential legal organizations to exist. In January of 2019, the Washington Post magazine wrote that the Federalist Society had reached an unprecedented peak of power and influence. And of the current nine members of the Supreme Court right now, six of them are current or former members of the organization. That'd be Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, Thomas, Roberts, Alito, and Barrett. And Politico wrote that the Federalist Society has become one of the most influential legal organizations in history, not only shaping law students' thinking, but changing American society itself by deliberately, diligently shifting the country's judiciary to the right. And basically, you can see it through their history. They were founded in 1982 by a group of students at Yale, Harvard, and UChicago. And they basically wanted to change this liberal or left-wing ideology that they perceived to dominate most elite American law schools and universities. And the organization's stated objectives are checking federal power, protecting individual liberty, and interpreting the Constitution according to its original meaning, which I have to say on a personal note is ludicrous. The founding fathers never expected us to be in a world in which we could shoot 60 bullets a second and had all of the world's knowledge in our pocket on a little light-up box. But never did they think that was possible. But according to Amanda Hollis Bruski, the Federalist Society has evolved into the de facto gatekeeper for the right of center lawyers aspiring to government jobs and federal judgeships under Republican presidents. And actually, according to William and Mary Law School and Ohio State University professor Lawrence Baum, the administration of Reagan and George W. Bush aimed to nominate conservative judges, and membership in the Federal Society was a proxy for adherence to conservative ideology. They also played a key role in suggesting judicial nominees to former President Donald Trump. It also vetted President Trump's list of potential U.S. Supreme Court nominees. And as of March 2020, 43 of the 51 of President Trump's appellate court nominees were current or former members of the society. So I don't know if that name drop like does it for people, but
at TU, we had definitely some people that were involved in the Federalist Society. I obviously was not, but they, I mean, I can see it as an ideology. I just wonder why they don't stick to it as much. Like, because when we're looking at like the death penalty, when we're looking at fines and fees and things like that, that is not limited government. So that's something that's interesting to me, is that sometimes individual liberty is important, sometimes it's not. It just more depends on the situation.
Yeah. I mean, I think we see that in the book too, when they really like decide to like dig in, and when they're like, that one doesn't necessarily serve us as much.
Yeah, like I would respect it as an ideology if people were consistent with it. I would respect it more. But when we're looking at these administrations, Reagan appointed three justices, Sandra Day O'Connor, Scalia, and Kennedy. And Bush appointed two, Souter and Clarence Thomas. So in theory, they should have all been conservative, but only really Scalia and Thomas turned out to be consistently conservative, with William Rehnquist, who Reagan made Chief Justice upon the retirement of Berger. They formed the conservative votes that began reshaping the decisions of the court. Clinton selected two justices, Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, who were consistently liberal voices. Already on the court was John Paul Stevens, who had been chosen by Gerald Ford. The 11 years that they served together from 1994 to 2005 was the longest period in United States history of the nine-member court with the same members. So the conservative movement in the 1980s began to have some successes in the 1990s. Their main target was Roe v. Wade, which had legalized abortion, and that had came close to being overturned in 1992 with the case of Casey v. Planned Parenthood. Only a last-minute coalition of Souter, O'Connor, and Kennedy protected Roe. The conservatives had more success in the area of religion. In general, they wanted to allow more religion in public life. So a series of cases was argued on the grounds of free speech rather than the free exercise clause. And the court allowed more things such as public displays of religions and student religious groups meeting on school grounds. However, at the end of the 1990s, the conservative movement lost some momentum in another abortion case, Stenberg. The court struck down laws restricting abortion because there was no exception for the health of the mother, which was something that O'Connor felt very strongly about.
Right. I think it's also, that's also foreshadowing to later when a similar law comes back up and O'Connor's no longer on the court, and she takes it really personally. So that's something to look forward to. But part two of the book then kind of moves on to outline the court's involvement in the presidential election of 2000. The Supreme Court ended up intervening and in effect deciding the election in favor of George W. Bush, who then became president. But it was an unusual move by the court, one that didn't have precedent, as well as one that set no precedent and dealt with no general principles, so to speak, moving forward. But what made it so controversial, Tubin writes, is that the decision was expressly limited to choosing the winner of that one election. So kind of this lack of precedent, you know, that's what we today know as the justice's job, or how we view it, is to set precedent in decisions that they make. But this one was decidedly different.
Bush v. Gore, which was decided on December 12th, 2000, settled a recount dispute in Florida's 2000 presidential election between Bush and Al Gore. And as always, when I'm going over these cases, this is just a quick recount, and I urge everyone to go read the cases themselves, because obviously a lawyer's job is to interpret the law and cases, but there's more than one interpretation. But on December 8th, the Florida Supreme Court had ordered a statewide recount of all undervotes, over 60,000 ballots that the vote tabulation machines had missed. So the Bush campaign immediately asked the Supreme Court to stay the decision and halt the recount. Scalia convinced that all the manual recounts being performed in Florida's counties were illegitimate, urged his colleagues to grant the stay. On December 9th, the five conservative justices on the court granted the stay for Bush, with Scalia citing irreparable harm that could befall Bush, as the recounts would cast a needless and unjustified cloud over Bush's legitimacy. In the dissent, John Paul Stevens wrote that counting every legally cast vote cannot constitute irreparable harm. Oral arguments were scheduled for December 11th. In a 5-4 per curiam decision, the court ruled strictly on equal protection grounds that the recount must be stopped. Specifically, the use of different standards of counting in different counties violated the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution, and the case had also been argued on the basis of Article II jurisdictional grounds, which found favor with only Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Rehnquist. The court then ruled as to a remedy, deciding against the remedy proposed by Breyer and Souter to send the case back to Florida to complete the recount using a uniform statewide standard before the scheduled December 18th meeting of the Florida's electors in Tallahassee. Instead, the majority held that no alternative method could be established within the discretionary December 12th safe harbor deadline set by Title III of the U.S. Code, Section 5, which the Florida Supreme Court had stated that the Florida legislature intended to meet. That deadline arrived 2 hours after the release of the court's decision, the court stating that not meeting the safe harbor deadline would therefore violate the Florida Election Code, reject an extension of the deadline. The Supreme Court decision allowed the previous vote certification made by Florida Secretary of State Katherine Harris to stand for Bush, who thereby won Florida's 25 electoral votes. Florida votes gave Bush, the Republican candidate, 271 electoral votes, one more than the 270 required to win the Electoral College. This meant the defeat of Democratic candidate Al Gore, who won 267 electoral votes, but received 266 as a faithless elector from D.C. abstained from voting. Media organizations later analyzed the ballots and found that under specified criteria, the originally pursued recount of undervotes of several large counties would have confirmed a Bush victory, whereas a statewide recount would have revealed a Gore victory. Florida later retired the punch card voting machines that produced the ballots disputed in this case.
I can't help but wonder if this helped to change any of the rhetoric that we see today, where people do often question elections, and when there's been a lot more question about authenticity when it comes to elections across the nation. I mean, of course, we've all seen some of the bigger ones, and we've seen them from certain parties, but I will say both parties continuously now play into this rhetoric of questioning the authenticity of elections and votes. And that's interesting. I've never thought until I was listening to you talk about it that I do wonder if this kind of helped to start that trend or push us in that direction.
Yeah, it's also interesting that in some ways with the digitalization of voting in a lot of places, it's probably less secure than it was in 2000 in some ways.
What a fun world we live in. So in the book, after 2000, the court moved leftward for several years, and this is the focus of part three. In large part, this was due to Kennedy and O'Connor, but Kennedy, in part, he was stung by the criticism the court received for their involvement in the Bush versus Gore. He also, though, was influenced by his increasing international excursions. In the 1990s, he began visiting Salzburg, Austria, each summer, and the book details this in great detail. After the fall of communism in Europe in the early 1990s, much focus was put on advising democracies. So both Kennedy and O'Connor took part in this, and these meetings and these discussions with international legal scholars, they had a big impact on Kennedy. Additionally, foreign judges were often guest speakers at the court's lunches. Over time, what had begun as a one-way flow of information with U.S. advising countries on drafting their constitutions started to become a two-way exchange of ideas. And European democracies were more liberal than the U.S. on many issues that they still are today. This was particularly true in areas such as the death penalty, and these ideas began to have a presence at the court. Kennedy and O'Connor often acted as a swing votes in cases, and references into international legal norms began to creep into Kennedy's opinions. This happened particularly in Lawrence v. Texas, a case that struck down a state prohibition on gay sex, and also in Roper v. Simmons, which involved the death penalty for minors. Another factor in the court's move left was that Chief Justice Rehnquist started growing weary of the job, it said, and didn't really put as much gusto into fighting for conservative issues. So his ideology didn't really change, but it's predicted or said that he basically kind of started just to say, like, hey, here's what we should do. And then if everyone was going to fight him, he was like, okay. There's a lot of cases that would come up again that just really focused on this swing vote. This time was, I didn't particularly know all the cases, but when I started reading them and even going back to look up more, there were so many cases that were swing cases that truly were up to debate at the end of the day, up to not really just a majority.
Some of the other examples of what you're talking about including Grutter v. Bollinger, which was 2003, and that affirmed the right of state colleges and universities to use affirmative action in their admissions policies to increase educational opportunities for minorities and promote racial diversity on campus. There was Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation versus the EPA in 2004, which said the EPA could step in and take action to reduce air pollution under the Clean Air Act when a state conservation agency fails to do so. And then a couple other examples that have been affected recently are Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which was a 5-4 majority affirming Roe v. Wade. I'm going to actually talk about this case for a second because I think it's important for people to understand exactly what constitutional law, like how it works at this high level. There's basically fundamental rights, and then there's rights that aren't fundamental rights. And fundamental rights have a history, a tradition, moral values, enumerated rights. The Supreme Court basically has held that some liberties are so important that they're deemed to be fundamental rights, and the government can't infringe upon them unless strict scrutiny has been met. And strict scrutiny means that a law is necessary to achieve a compelling governmental interest and the law is narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. So usually when you're deciding a constitutional law case, they're safeguarded under two places. One is the right to due process, and that's when the constitutional issue is whether the government's interference is justified by a sufficient purpose. That's like when a law denies a right to everyone. But then if the right is protected under equal protection, the issue is whether the government's discrimination as to who can exercise the right is justified by a sufficient purpose. So you see those when that is divided, when the law only applies to a certain group. So when we see in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, there was abortion was considered a fundamental right for a period, but Planned Parenthood v. Casey stood for the proposition that states cannot prohibit abortion prior to viability, but they can restrict it in some way so long as it does not place an undue burden from having access to that abortion. If the regulation's purpose or effect is to place a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion, then it's a constitutional violation. So it's just, I think people don't fully understand what these constitutional issues stand for. First, they can only apply to a governmental action, and there is varying degrees of scrutiny applied.
I think it's interesting to look at what this court upheld when we look at McCreary County versus ACLU of Kentucky, and they ruled that it was unconstitutional to display, as Mike said, the Ten Commandments in several courthouses. And Justice Sandra Day O'Connor had some really strong language. She said, "Those who would renegotiate the boundaries between church and state must therefore answer a difficult question. Why would we trade a system that has served us so well for one that has served others so poorly?" And so we see this shift of when in 2005 they were deciding that there are lines between church and state. And then today, of recent, with the Kennedy versus Bremerton School District, we do see a shift in that.
Yeah, Kennedy v. Bremerton School District, which was a 6-3 ruling in favor of Joseph Kennedy, who claimed that his school district violated his religious freedom by telling him he couldn't pray so publicly after the games. The district said it was trying to avoid the appearance that the school was endorsing a religious point of view, since the coach was not only an employee, but in a position of power.
There was, I can't remember the case off the top of my head, but there was a specific case in which public schools came up in the Supreme Court before this. The case did not find that the employees of public schools had the right to use prayer in their classrooms and at sporting events. And so this particular case of Kennedy versus Bremerton is definitely a flip on an issue that, you know, we're seeing did happen in this time, but it did not move forward regardless of having conservative majority. Then the book moves on after kind of looking at that and does go into that resurgence of the conservative movement after 2005. That was the year that O'Connor retired and Rehnquist passed away. And this gave Bush the opportunity to fill two seats with much firmer conservatives, so to speak, John Roberts, who became their Chief Justice, and Alito. And before moving on, I just want to say that Rehnquist's death ended his 33-year tenure on the Supreme Court, and he served as Chief Justice for 19. I would just like to say that that is longer than I've been alive, his tenure. Kind of in this vein, recently, Biden put together a commission to study options for the Supreme Court reform in 2021. And the commission, made up of legal scholars, recommended term limits for justices in a report that was published that December. Also in current news, I guess, or just to kind of put it contextually to what we're hearing today, this also kind of pivots to the question of expanding the court. There have been a lot of calls to expand the court as of now due to recent ongoings, mostly made by progressive Democrats, including AOC. And this is possible because the size of the nation's top court isn't actually specified in the Constitution. There's nowhere that says the number in which how many justices should sit on there. And although the Supreme Court has had 9 justices for the past 150 years, it's not bound to only have 9. Over the years, it's had as many as 10 and as few as 5. But the idea behind it is that expanding the court would allow Democrats to counteract the conservative Republican supermajority that was established when former President Trump nominated 3 conservative justices during his administration that were also very firm, so to speak. But historically, that's actually an interesting and accurate political move, so to speak. An example is that the Congress at the time did not like President Andrew Johnson. He was Abe Lincoln's vice president and successor. But Congress wasn't fond of him, and the members thought that he had abused his presidential power by removing the respected Secretary of War of the time, Edward Stanton. And they wanted to limit his power as much as they could. So they passed legislation in 1866 that decreased the number of judges from 10 to 7 so that Johnson wouldn't be able to appoint a new justice. That was kind of short-lived because the Supreme Court shrank to only 8 justices before the 1969 decision to set the number at 9. And not coincidentally, this is the same year that Andrew Johnson ceased to be president. Congress wasn't the only branch of government to attempt to alter the power structure. President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, proposed a reorganization bill to Congress that would allow the president to appoint a new justice for each one who was at least 70 years old. Congress, shockingly, did not oblige. This was seen as court packing scheme that would have given Roosevelt too much power, and Roosevelt's motives were to push his New Deal through, which we know worked, but if you fast forward back to where we were talking about in 2006 and 2007, the change was clear that the court has moved back to the right on cases involving some of the key issues we've talked about so far and a few more. But one of the examples was in 2 school desegregation cases, the court found that race could not be a factor in determining where students went to school, even when designed to help minority students. And then additionally, there was an abortion case that decided that upheld restrictions to abortion in federal law that was very similar to the state law that the court had earlier struck down.
Yeah, it was a decision drafted by Justice Alito that approved a law that required women to prove they had notified their husbands before they could have an abortion. And to O'Connor, Alito's view was, and I'm quoting, repugnant. Women, she said, do not lose their constitutionally protected rights when they marry. His appointment as her successor infuriated her.
Yeah, that's an understatement when we read this book. I said it before, but I have to say it again. This book was really sympathetic to O'Connor, I think for decent reason, personally, when reading it, but it was super sympathetic. The book really focused on the alienation of O'Connor from the Republican Party, which is also really interesting in this moment, as we do see so much turmoil in both parties, but predominantly the Republican Party at the moment. And I mean, of course, all of the January 6th committee hearings we are seeing just a further polarization within the party as well. So that's interesting. But ironically, Toobin tells us if there was a contemporary politician that O'Connor really admired, it was the governor of Texas, which was George W. Bush, a man whose theme of compassionate conservatism was much like O'Connor's, or so she thought. Instead, says Toobin, O'Connor came to disdain the Bush presidency, and it was a transformation that did not happen overnight, but with each step that President Bush took, whether to exert unilateral executive power in the war on terror or on social issues like abortion, separation of church and state, affirmative action, and gay rights, she also kind of became fed up, which, you know, we already kind of talked about that kind of feeling. But she was healthy, 75 years old, which is insane to say, in June of 2005, in the prime of her judicial influence, if you look at age of other justices and how long they lasted. But her husband's Alzheimer's took a turn for the worst, and she didn't want to leave the court, but with the ailing Chief Justice Rehnquist telling her he was going to hang on, she felt she had no choice but to step down to avoid a double vacancy in the future. But then, of course, fate decided otherwise, and Rehnquist died weeks after, and O'Connor's husband would not recognize her within a matter of months and would have to be institutionalized. But her retirement did lead to a large shift, as we detailed above, and it reminds me, as the late Justice William Brennan liked to state, the most important law at the Supreme Court is the law of five. With five votes, you can do anything here, he would say.
Yeah, Tobin also, speaking about O'Connor, was talking about how much she had an uncanny ear for the American public opinion, and she consciously kept her rulings closely tethered to what most people wanted, or at least would accept. So no one ever pursued centrism and moderation, those passionless creeds, with greater passion than O'Connor. No justice ever succeeded more in putting her stamp on the law of a generation. Similarly interesting to me, though, were the portraits of the justices that were weaved throughout the book, revealing stories he uses to paint these mini biographies, so to speak. One starting example was David Souter, appointed by George H.W. Bush in 1990, and later became a textbook example of the way in which justices often have surprised and disappointed the presidents appointing them. Considered leaving the court in 2001 when frustration over the decision in Bush v. Gore. He said there were times when David Souter thought of Bush v. Gore and wept.
Right. And in the final section of the nine, Tobin focuses on the process that led to the selection of John Roberts as first an associate judge and shortly thereafter Chief Justice when Rehnquist passed in 2005. And Samuel Alito to fill the seat of O'Connor in 2006. And another kind of mini biography moment, so to speak, was speaking on the fact that President Bush almost certainly would have preferred different individuals than these for the seats. He would have preferred his Texas colleagues and friends, Albert Gonzalez and Harriet Myers, for those seats, but neither could withstand the ideological scrutiny of the conservative legal and political groups. And then coming on the heels of Hurricane Katrina at this time, the Myers confirmation fiasco was a particular mark for the Bush administration, and he became very conscious of his image and very conscious. I mean, all presidents, all politicians are. That's an important part of their journey as politicians, is their image. And so for this reason, he pivoted back to the Federalist Society and kind of allowed their input and their take. And that's why we even saw who we saw up, which I just think is so interesting when we look at the influence that some of these groups and people have that we don't even know about until, you know, years later, and you really push into the issue, you can see like, oh, this would have been this person said, actually, I remember one of the Kumho, it was Mario Kumho, actually was like number one for the seat for Bush, which is the father of the former, well, he was a governor of New York, but then he's also the father of the former Andrew Kumho, who was the governor of New York. Yeah, I don't know. I just think it's interesting when we look at this of like, oh, they would have wanted this, but someone else said it was this, and just how much the courts really would have changed if certain people did and didn't get involved.
Yeah, the alternate history timelines are endless.
It's true. Part of the multiverse.
But in the end, Tubin concludes that there's little difference between the left and right of the court in terms of legal skills. What separates the justices is ideology. Future justices will all likely be similarly qualified to meet the basic requirements of the job, and it is their ideologies that will shape the court and thus the nation. While predicting the longevity of Supreme Court justices can be a risky business, there's a good chance that the next president will have the opportunity to fill at least two vacancies, most likely from the court's liberal wing.
Yeah, I had a lot of issues with his conclusions, but I mean, as a nod to him, I'm coming from the now. I'm coming from the Supreme Court decisions we just saw. I'm coming from a totally different environment than this book was written, so I do want to say that.
Well, I'm not saying that it should fall to ideology, but I do agree that it does to some extent, because what we see is that, I mean, if you look over a long enough lens, politics is transitory. people that would have been Democrats in like the 1820s would probably be Republicans now. The ideology behind it is what stays consistent. So I would say, like if you look at executive power, we saw FDR create huge new executive powers, but we saw the same thing with, as we talked about earlier, George W. Bush is expanding executive power. Obama expanded executive power. It's not necessarily, not everything is a right and left issue. It's more an ideological issue about how you feel about executive power, which isn't so clean cut into left-right dichotomy. And we see that with a lot of, like, I would say probably around like 80 to 90% of the cases that the Supreme Court is deciding don't have a direct political analog. But that 10%, we do see that there is a political ideology behind it, but it's not necessarily, I would say, Republican, Democrat in all cases. And it's also important, I think, we're talking about the Supreme Court because that gets, you know, all the headlines. But even your local judge has an ideology. It's just how much of that ideology is put into the decisions they're making. That's, I think, is the key when we're looking at judges.
Right. Yeah. I think I just balk, or I kind of bristle at the, I think that individualism that's just ever present when people are involved is really where I start to take issue with it. But, you know, like you said, it's just, it's so robust, and it always has these confounding factors as well. You know, a lot of these Republicans, or a lot of these politicians, I should say, make their decisions based in a religion that they believe in, which factors into their ideology and their morals. And so where that individualism mixes with a party's values, I guess, is why. That's like really the basis of where I get fired up.
Yeah, it's just an interesting issue because, like, at the structure, like, we're all taught in fundamental civics class that the Supreme Court is a non-political body that is interpreting the law, but I just... that was obviously an ideal that hasn't been obtained and probably isn't possible to obtain because people are political.
Right, right. No, I do agree with that. I completely do. I do think, interestingly enough, so Mike and I both have taken both a lot of personal interest and then educational classes as well. Both of us majored in basically an area that's very similar to this. I majored in international relations and him in history, and I think something that also makes this book so fascinating in this moment, outside of the obvious, of course, we're getting some very, very large cases that are changing the trajectory of the United States at the moment, and is, of course, extremely conservative. We have definitely pivoted back or exceeded the previous conservative movement that we just kind of chatted about. But something that's interesting and plays into this that I think the book missed, something it missed due to just being in 2007 and not yet really having time to see what's happening now in the United States, something that I would say is an added factor now, is the polarization of politics in the United States. I took a lot of classes on this, and this was actually what my advisor, Ken Schultz, it's what he studies, and he's a brilliant man if you ever go look at some of his studies out of Stanford. Basically, the overall share of Americans who express consistently conservative or consistently liberal opinions has doubled over the past two decades, from 10% to about 21%. And ideological thinking is now much more closely aligned with partisanship than in the past. As a result of this, the ideological overlap between the two parties has greatly diminished. Today, about 92% of Republicans are to the right of the median Democrat, and 94% of Democrats are to the left of the median Republican. This partisan animosity has increased substantially over the same period. In each party, the share with a highly negative view of the opposing party has more than doubled since 1994. Most of these intense partisan believing the opposing party's policies are so misguided that they threaten the nation's well-being. I mean, we've heard this rhetoric and we see it today for sure. It created these ideological silos that are completely common in both parties. But people with down the line ideological positions are more likely than others to say that most of their close friends share their political views. This also led to the rise of ideological uniformity, which is so interesting. And Gen Z has got a lot to say about it. It's been more pronounced among those who are politically active. Today, almost 4 in 10, or about 38% of politically engaged Democrats, are consistent liberals, up from just 8% in 1994. And the change among Republicans since then appears a little bit less dramatic. It's 33% express consistently conservative views, up from 23% in the midst of the 1994 Republican Revolution. But a decade ago, just 10% of politically engaged Republicans had across the board conservative attitudes. So this now leads to families, in contrast, are becoming more politically homogenous. And this is really the area that a lot of Gen Z digs into, because it's so glaringly obvious for that generation when this is missing. But as of 2018, 80% of marriages had spousal alignment on party affiliation, and parent-child agreement was 75%. My generation didn't have 75%. But both of these represent significant increases from family homogeneity in the 1960s. And a 2022 study found that there had been a substantial increase since 1980 in political polarization among adults. Basically, that was driven by parental influence. Now that's what we're seeing for like my generation and my generation and kind of my parents a little bit as well.
Yeah, I wonder, I'm interested in, you were talking about how the polarization is moving faster than in other industrialized countries. And I wonder how much of that is just based on a strictly two-party system compared to the multiple parties that you see in a lot of Europe. But a Brown University study released in 2020 found that the U.S. was polarizing faster compared to other democratic countries such as Canada, the U.K., Germany, and Australia. According to Stony Brook University political scientists Yana Krupnikov and John Barry Ryan, polarization in American politics is primarily a phenomenon among Americans who are deeply involved in politics and are very expressive about their political views. Americans who are not as involved in politics are not as polarized. As of February 2020, a study conducted by the Pew Research Center highlights the current political issues that have the most amount of partisanship. By far, addressing climate change is the most partisan issue, with only 21% of Republicans considering it a top policy priority, as opposed to 78% of Democrats. Other issues that are extremely partisan include protecting the environment, reforming gun policy, and military spending. These differences in policy priorities emerge as both Democrats and Republicans shift their focus away from improving the economy. Since 2011, both parties have gradually placed economic stimulation and job growth lower on their priority list, with Democrats experiencing a sharper decline of importance when compared to Republicans. This is in stark contrast to the 1990s, when both Democrats and Republicans shared similar views on climate change and showed significantly more agreement. A poll conducted by Gallup identifies issues where the partisan gap has significantly increased over a period of about 15 years. For Republicans, the most significant shift was the idea that the federal government has too much power, with 39% Republicans agreeing with that in 2002, as opposed to 82% agreeing in 2016. On the Democratic side, the largest shift was increasing favorability towards Cuba, changing from 32% in 2002 to 66% in 2017. Ultimately, as partisanship continues to permeate and dominate policy, citizens who adhere and align themselves with political parties become increasingly polarized.
I think, and there definitely are some issues that have wide public consensus. Partisan politics still divides citizens regardless. Something that I thought of while you're talking is how there are a certain generation of people, usually a little bit older, but there's certain people who say, you know, like, we don't have to agree and we can still be friends. And then there's a lot of people, especially of the younger generation, that are just like, no, negative, especially with some of the more high profile decisions that are coming out now. A lot of people are really deciding, like, no, if you stand on one side, that is consequential to me. It's just splitting a lot more. I would just be interested, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, in how this is going to further polarize where we're already at, as we're seeing such divisive things decided. We're really truly getting into issues that really don't have a middle ground, it seems, especially with some of the decisions that have just come out of the court. We really don't have another one that just came out of the court that probably hasn't been chatted about as much, since it's not quite as impactful, but the Supreme Court just decided that Oklahoma has concurrent jurisdiction with the tribal districts, meaning that they can proceed in criminal court. Oh, we're thinking it's criminal court. I think there's a little bit of wiggle room in that people aren't 100% sure it's only criminal court, but that the state can move forward with criminal court cases of non-Native individuals, regardless if the crime happened on Native land. Previously, due to McGirt, that was not the case. But I even think decisions like that are actually pretty polarized. I think in Oklahoma, unfortunately, the constant politicization of that issue, particularly with our governor, has really actually led to that being even less of like a middle ground situation. I think that's interesting. Just that I think a lot of our issues are actually moving towards that no wiggle room, you're on one side or the other kind of situation.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see. Historically, we've seen it be highly polarized. I mean, let's be clear, the country fought a civil war, so that's probably as polarized as it can get. But we've seen it go to that extreme and then consensus be drawn. So I could see it going either way. It could be towards the more extreme. It could move back towards consensus. It'll just be interesting to see. So to wrap this up, there's a beautiful image in the book when Tubin explains that the Supreme Court building was designed by Cass Gilbert in 1935, and he refers to it both in the prologue and the epilogue. The design was a workaround for the tight space allotted for the structure, so rather than building a long approach to give a sense of awe to the building, which you see in a lot of other governmental buildings, Gilbert used a high staircase of 44 steps to create an elevation. This was both literal and figurative, as the steps signify the court as an institution that was above everyday politics. This is the impression visitors to the court got climbing the steps to the entrance. Tubin introduces this idea right away, but notes that the truth about the court has always been more complicated. His entire book is an effort to show that, in fact, the court is not above politics. At the end, the steps make another appearance, as Tubin states in the epilogue that with heightened security after September 11th attacks, the steps had been closed as an entrance, and visitors entered on the side but still exited down the steps and watched Gilbert's vision recede behind him, with the implication being that the idea of the court being above politics is also receding.
I would just say in conclusion that what we're doing here is analyzing a book, of course, but we're also analyzing the history of the Supreme Court and kind of this movement that we've seen for decades now that has led us to where we are. We're really here to allow people to make their own decisions, to really be educated about the issue. I mean, I didn't know coming into this that, so to speak, where we're at today is kind of been predicted. I mean, when we really start looking at the history and when we start looking at this conservative push, especially when it comes to the Supreme Court, that was something that I didn't know about, and I think really continues to shape how I view some of the issues of today. This episode, it's meant to give people more education, more ability to process some of the things that are happening as well, and just look at the history to hopefully see where we're going. And if not, it'll just urge you to vote. At least that's something that will come from the current situation, is hopefully a large uptick in voting.
Yeah, I found this book interesting as well. I have worked for several judges when I was in Guam, and obviously not on the Supreme Court level, but I did see that every judge has their own way of doing things. I can only imagine that that's true for every judge ever. The legal system is not an unbiased machine like we like to picture it, but each individual is bringing in their own ideologies and their own thoughts. That's just the way that it works, which is why one of the advantages that local lawyers have when they're in the court is they understand what the judge wants. And that is something that we don't think about a lot, is that each individual has their own ideology and way of doing things, and that's going to come through regardless.
I think also when we're kind of looking forward, the Supreme Court has already made it clear what cases they would like to review next, and I would encourage people to begin to research. I think power is really, really informative, and I think that a lot of people are feeling reasonably overwhelmed with a lot of the decisions that are coming out of the court. So I just strongly encourage people to, if you can, take a step back and start to see the history of that case. Like Mike said, go read that case, interpret it for yourself. Because I think as a generation, when we begin to sit in these positions and when we begin to shape the nation, it's important that we do so from a place of education. And it's important that we see our history. It's important that we see where we were to shape where we're going. There's more to come from this court. A tool that's on your side is education, and it can help us move forward.
For an historical understanding, it's important to understand the people that make these decisions. So it was an interesting read, especially with, you get a real sense of their personalities and how that is driving partially their decisions.
With that, we hope you watch our other episodes, and we hope to see you back next week.